All right, we're going to get started. Hello and welcome to the Free from Relapse panel discussion. My name is Sharon. I'm a compulsive overeater. Hello. Relapse is a very common story in our fellowship. Some members relapse and are never heard from again. Others have the willingness and courage to return and try again. The speakers on the panel have all struggled with relapse but have returned to have long-term abstinence. In today's session, we will hear from each of our speakers for 20 minutes and then have questions and answers for the final 20 minutes of our time. Without further delay, I would like to introduce Susan S., who will share with us for 20 minutes. You're not Susan S. Susan G. Some Susan.
Hi, I'm Susan, compulsive overeater. I'm not very graceful, so I'm not going to hopefully trip. Anyway, suddenly I just looked over at my friend. I go, my palms are sweating. All of a sudden, I can. And I can also talk very, very loud, so no problem. Anyway, just to qualify, and even if you don't identify with this part of my story, hopefully other parts you will, my top weight was 250 pounds, size 26 dress. I came to my first meeting in 1983, and I got abstinent in 1999. So I did a lot of this in between, and as this is being taped, a lot of up and down. I've lost 100 pounds probably 5 or 6 times. I'm a really, really good dieter. I like to win. I like to be at the front of the class and get the badges. But then when that's all over, I don't know how to stop eating. I don't know what to do because diets work if you aren't a food addict, and I am a food addict. So my story, I was always heavy. I was always the heavier girl in class. I used to do ballet and have the thickest legs and all those kinds of things, but I still did them. Always felt uncomfortable, but never grew up, you know, being patronized by anybody in my life that I was heavier, which was very, very nice. I had a great group of friends. I'm very social. My disease doesn't take me to isolation, so that's just my story. It doesn't have to be yours. Everybody comes from a different place. Like I said, I'm a really, really good dieter, so if there's a party or an occasion, I walk in looking stunning and hot. If you see me 3 weeks later, you go, oh, wow, hi, because you are horrified that I have probably gained 30 or 40 pounds. If you're in these rooms, you aren't horrified, but if you're just a regular person outside, you're thinking, what the just happened? And I would probably tell you I was swollen or I had a thyroid issue I was trying to work out. I've been to every thyroid doctor in the San Fernando Valley because I so badly wanted something to be wrong with me because I couldn't understand what was right, that I could lose this weight and then wake up one morning and jeans like these would be, you know, 3 or 4 sizes away. It just wasn't normal. So a friend brought me to these rooms many, many years ago, and I was not having it. I didn't like it. I didn't like the word Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone compulsive overeater. And I didn't know anything. And that probably was the best place to be. And if only I would have said to somebody, I know nothing, please help me, it would have been terrific. That wasn't it. I had a lot of self-will and a lot of ego. And I have been everywhere to diet. I've done all the injections, all the shots. I had something called a gastric bubble. I've had my mouth wired. I've done it all. And you know you're in trouble when you have your mouth wired and all you can think about is you're paying this person to do it illegally because who does that? I think I can feel with my tongue there's a little hole there in the back. I'm going to be able to eat. It's going to be okay. Leaving there and going to a drive-thru and getting something really cold with loads of calories and 3 months later having lost no weight. So that's why I know I belong in these rooms. And as I tell you this story, it still makes my heart pound. So I know that I'm in the right place because I know that my ego would take me right out. And relapse is, it's just really, really hard. It's an army. It's a battle that I just couldn't fight. It's so much stronger than I am, so much stronger. And each time I get kicked down, not only am I kicked down, for me it's 15 more pounds, 10 more pounds. The weight keeps going up. And I can remember always thinking, I'll never be 175. Well, then I'll never be 190. Suddenly I'm 198. I'll never weigh 200. No, you won't, because now you're 205. So that's where the cunning, baffling, you know, part of this disease comes in. So eventually, thank goodness, I did get really, really scared. And one more time, there I was again. And I just had the realization that 250 wasn't the end of the story. And I knew that 300 was waving to me and saying, come on, this is fantastic. We welcome you. You know, my relapse and my disease welcomes all members. There are no boundaries. It doesn't care what color eyes I have, whether I have straight hair, curly hair. It just doesn't matter. So I finally got willing because I got scared that I'd be one of those people sitting on their couches who couldn't get up. That I'd be one of those TLC shows of how you couldn't lose, you know, leave your house. And if you have had the burden of extra weight, you know that feeling and what I'm talking about because it happens so quickly. Talk about the blink of an eye. It really, really does. It's really quite horrifying. You know, that scale goes like this. It's shocking. So, you know, here I am today. What happened? What was different? I got scared. I came in. I found somebody who was willing to help me. And I shut up. And I have a lot to say always. But I learned here, do I want to be right or do I want to be abstinent? Of course I want to be right. Who doesn't want, I want you to see my point of view. Of course I do. But I didn't want to weigh 300 pounds. And I had that constant knocking. Come on over. It's really cheap over here. And I took clear cut direction from this woman for 5 years. No less, actually it was three. And I called her in the morning. I would commit my food in the morning because as somebody said this morning on another panel, I can't help you at night. If there's been an issue during the day, I can't help you if you're telling me at night. And that's so true. And I still decide on my food in the morning, commit it, and my sponsee is the same way. And also I want that freedom. I don't want to go to the debating society at lunchtime, at dinner time when I come home and having half a meal standing at the fridge door. I'm sure that you can relate to that. I want to live life, and that's what I get to do now, instead of having that constant demoralization that I did it wrong one more time. So I put down the fork, I picked up the pen, and I worked the steps. And I didn't work, don't be offended, I didn't work the five-year program of doing the steps. They were worked very, very quickly, in a good way, in a clear and concise way. You know, I did my inventory, she gave me a certain amount of time and I did it. And it didn't have to be legal binders full of, you know, well, I trod on Mary Jane's toe in the schoolyard and I'm sure she's still upset. It was the things, you know, those secrets were as sick as our secrets. And I had to get that out on paper, the things that felt shameful to me. You know, and each inventory has evolved because as I've grown, you know, as what my sponsor of 10 years told me, you know, you need to find your authentic self. You need to find your truth. And that's really hard to know when you're hiding behind, you know, a size 26 dress. That there's a lot there that you don't want to feel and that you don't want to see and you certainly don't want to touch on it. And you don't want to say it out loud because that's just horrifying. So I did the steps. She told me to go to committed meetings, have people get to know me. I really didn't want to know any of you. And now my best friends are in these rooms. So everything I thought I knew when I came in was a load of rubbish. It was absolute, I'm not going to swear, but it was. And today it isn't true. You know, one of my closest friends in these rooms, I was just her maid of honor at her wedding and my pleasure, you know. And that's the kinds of things that we get to do here today. I have very, very different special friendships in these rooms. We bond in a totally different way. I don't have to get to know you. You're here at Overeaters Anonymous. I know you. I know that your head talks to you the same way that mine does. And today, you know, in that recovery from relapse, I can tell you that my food, one day at a time, doesn't talk to me. My food used to disco dance for me. It had a little sparkly ball over there. And I live in the truth, and I commit, and I do the work, and I show up more than anything, and I take that clear-cut direction, even if I don't like it. And half the time, we all do it. You pull away the phone, and you think, what planet are you on? That wasn't what I was saying I wanted to do. And as we heard this morning, some of us were in the Big Book workshop, this isn't a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. And I like to think today that I do it. I show up. I have a morning routine. I read 2 daily readers. I read Upon Awakening. My food, you know, for me, my abstinence and my food plan are 2 entirely different things. And if you want to know more about that afterwards, I'll tell you. But for me, my abstinence is no flour, no sugar. I can't go near those foods. I don't understand a cone. I only understand a gallon. And I don't understand a slice. It has to be a loaf. And that's just the beginning. So those, you know, those are my heroine. Those are places that I cannot go to. My life is so much easier today being abstinent. You know, I don't have to think every Sunday night, number one, what am I going to wear to work tomorrow? Because who knows why over the weekend. These are jeans that I've owned over 5 years. and I can wash them and put them on. That's not me on my own. That's through all of you. That's through a power greater than myself. And learning that, you know, this program is portable. I take God with me 24 hours a day. Instead of that constant fight of shall we, shan't we, should I, must I. And today I don't have to must. I don't have to this because I should. I just do it because I want to. And that's the honest truth. There's a glide today that I have that I don't have when I'm eating because I'm constantly looking for that next hit. And when I'm eating, you all look very, very different to me. I don't like any of you. And you're all mean to me. Everybody's mean to me and nobody understands. And I'm sorry, but, and with all due respect, if you only knew who I was, well, be quiet. Be quiet. I have a friend in these rooms who's sitting in here now that tells her sponsees to turn to the first page of the big book. What is that first page? It's when you open the cover page and it's blank and you know nothing. And I wish I would have been told that, you know, in the beginning, because I know a lot, but I don't know how to stop eating. I do know a lot. There's many things I could probably show you and you could show me. But when it comes to compulsive overeating, I knew nothing. And those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have saved my life. They really, really have. So if you are struggling today and you don't have a sponsor, that's the first thing I would strongly suggest that you do, because I don't see any way that you can give away your fourth and fifth step to yourself. It's just kind of not going to work. And when it comes to amends, I can guarantee that I would have told myself, well, but let's just go back to that one. You don't need to go to Gelson's and apologize for all the grapes and bags of chips that you ate while you were going down the aisles. But my sponsor had me go. And if you don't think that is humiliating, oh, my goodness. It is. But you know what? I did it. Am I a better person for it today? No, not really. But I didn't eat for that day. And for the days that have followed, I haven't eaten. So that's what they've done. Again, you know, I have integrity today. I'm authentic. You know, now I know, do I want to be right or do I want to be abstinent? And again, I still want to be abstinent more than I want to be right. If you're going to tread on my toe and tell me you're not on it, I am going to kind of fight you and push you off my foot. Okay, so in that regard, I want to be right. But in other things, how important is it? It really isn't. And I just used to fight for those wrong things, you know, just for everybody to understand me. And then one day I really read the doctor's opinion. And then I started to understand myself because that allergy, that was exactly what happened. Once that basket would come to the table, I didn't even know that you were sitting there. And I really hope that you had your own because, you know, it is, and it's, you know, you can't stop. You know, once you start shooting up, it's all over. I hate to sound so crass, but that's how food is for me. Once I have that first bite, there isn't a big enough pizza box. There isn't enough of anything. And then the next day, there's that feeling of just complete demoralization. I'm just taken out. Everybody hates me. Nobody likes me because I'm fat. And who doesn't like me because I'm fat? Me. Because I feel so crummy, so hungover, just so shitty. And you know, I didn't bring photos today, but you know, in my pictures, I'm very nicely dressed. I have very curly hair, really. I straighten it. So you see my big 80s hair out here, and I've got the makeup on and all the dresses. But I was freaking miserable. It doesn't matter how I found those outfits, and my big clothes were better than yours. It doesn't matter. You know what? Today, again, it's about freedom from bondage of self. And by continually doing this work, and, you know, Jeff called me and asked me, it's like, oh, I don't know, I'm going to get sweaty palms, it's so many people. But I just say yes. As all of that's happening, yes is coming out of my mouth. There's no, I will call you back, I will let you know. I was raised in these rooms that we don't do that. Unless I'm physically not going to be in the country, or if you ask me to do something at 2 p.m, it's on a Wednesday, I have to work. So I stick within the truth. But if it's a meeting that's a little bit out of the way, I can leave work 15 minutes earlier and get there. That's my insurance. And that's my, you know, that's passing on the message. And that's what I constantly need to do is to share this with others. That's why I work with others. I try not to say no to people if they ask me to sponsor them. Because if people had always said no to me or, oh, you always come and then you won't stay, where would I be today? I wouldn't have come back. So I'm so grateful for the people, you know, who have sponsored me. And I was talking about this before with a friend. Recently, I changed sponsors after 10 years for various reasons. And it's kind of weird starting a new relationship. But this woman has 28 years in this program, 29 in AA. And she's not my friend, and that's okay. She's not nice to me. but she's there to give me clear-cut direction, and that's what she gives to me. And at first it was very squirmy and very weird, and she does it a little, you know, this is the times I'm available, and it's like, oh, okay. And now I'm just doing it, and now we're in a flow, and it's okay, because we have that same obsession of the mind that we have worked through, or continually a day at a time. And the great thing for me here is you don't give me a ribbon like they did at Weight Watchers. You don't ask me to audition for commercials like they did at Nutrisystem. There's no finish line. And that's what really, really helps me, because I like to be winner-winner. I like to be the top of the class. If any of you know anything about European schools, I was head girl. And that means that you get voted in to be the head of all the kids. And that was me, and that's who I like to be. I'm the oldest of 7 children. I know how to get things done. But here I don't have to do that. I don't have to get anything done. All I can do is share with you today my truth and hope that if you are struggling, that you've heard something, that you do keep coming back. And when you keep coming back, that you do the work and don't try and do it alone. So thank you, Jeff, who's out there somewhere, for asking me to speak. And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Now we have Susan H., and I believe I have the correct initial.
Hi, I'm Susie. I'm a compulsive overeater. And just to qualify, let's see. I've been in program for about 25 years, currently abstinent for over 8 years, so you do the math. That was 17 and a half years of relapse. My relapse was all in program. Let's see. I'm from outside of Chicago. I'm 62, born Jewish but raised to be an atheist, so I had a little difficulty when I came in, you know, creating a spiritual life, but I have created one, thank God. Top weight ever was 205 the first time that I was pregnant. That was before I came into program. By the time I came in, I think I was at about 185, and now I've stayed at about 145 for a number of years. So that's kind of the statistics there. I actually came into program first in 1979 in Philadelphia, used it as a diet club, lost 20 pounds, and went away. But when I came back 10 years later, I was thoroughly beaten, came in Connecticut, and I've stayed ever since then. So as a big-time relapser, I would say that I've made pretty much every mistake that you can make in this program except for one. I didn't go away. I always kept coming back. Couldn't think of any place else to go. And that is the only thing that has saved my butt through the years, is that I did that. You know, I was just sort of a goody-goody kind of kid, a good little doobie that wanted to be praised and liked and stuff like that. I was kind of chubby from a young age, but not obese or anything like that. But I knew I didn't look right. My mother certainly knew I didn't look right. And I was bribed with stereos and this and that, if you just lose weight and blah, blah, blah. By the time that I got to college, I was using my freedom and my pocket money to get food and eat food. And, you know, binging really came in a big way when I had the freedom and the ability to do that. I think when I was 22 in grad school, I was about the weight that I am now, which at 22 is just a horrifying, horrifying thing to weigh over 140. But I continued to diet and, you know, go up, go down, yo-yo, all over the place, all kinds of diets, all the commercial diet clubs. I lived near New York for a long time, and I went to a really expensive diet doctor in New York for a while. It gave me a really restrictive diet and tapes to listen to and stuff like that, and I got down to 125, where I stayed for about a minute, and, you know, right back up. And, you know, so then stuck at 165 for a bunch of time, and then stuck at 185 for a bunch of time. That pregnancy that ended at 205 started at 195, so it's not that I gained so much during the pregnancy. Anyway, when I came in, as I said, in Connecticut. The meetings were not that great then, but I came in really beaten and willing to do anything that anybody told me to do. So I did everything. I became abstinent right away. I had a real pink cloud abstinence. You know, they told me to put up my hand to be a sponsor. I did that. They told me to work the Westminster questions. I did that. They told me to do service. I did that. And so for 9 months, everything was great. And then I went on a vacation. I stayed abstinent through the vacation. Felt a little upset stomach on the way home. I was in an airport lounge, picked up a piece of fruit that was not on my food plan for the day, and that kicked off a relapse. And that relapse went for about 9 months, and I was completely mystified, because the program as I had it at that point, I had a sponsor, and I was doing steps, And I even had gone on to a second sponsor because my first sponsor had lost her abstinence. But I was very confused about what was the program. I often thought, you know, maybe it's the tools that are the program. Maybe it is the fellowship and the hugs that is the program. And it wasn't until I got my third sponsor, who had a very strong AA program as well as OA, that I found out that it was actually the steps that were the program. So at any rate, I was in this relapse, and I was still going to my meetings, and I saw somebody in the meetings that when I started, she had been thin, and now she was fat, and I thought, well, maybe she's in a relapse. Maybe she knows something to tell me about this. So I called her up, and I said, can you talk to me about relapse? And she said, are you going to the meeting tonight? And I said, yeah. She said, well, let's go out for coffee afterwards. So we went to the meeting, we went out for coffee, and she said, I am just now coming out of my relapse, and the way that I'm doing that is I talked to somebody else, and I said, you know, how do you get out of relapse? And she said to me, look, there's this whole program here. Why don't you just do the program? So I sort of thought about that, and I was like, well, yeah, there is a lot of stuff here that I am not doing. So I thought, what could I do? It occurred to me, I was going to two meetings a week, and it occurred to me I could try going to more meetings. So I tried going to more meetings, and it was at a meeting that I heard this third sponsor that I got, and she had also been abstinent for a while in relapse, and now she had 9 months abstinent after her relapse. So I buzzed up to her and asked her if she would sponsor me, which she agreed to do. So as I say, I learned a lot about, you know, a real hardcore program from her. However, we were working a fourth step. I was, you know, writing it according to her directions. And I think somewhere in there I lost my abstinence. And I told her the truth, and we reset, and we went back to step one. And the same thing, got up to step four, somewhere in there, lost my abstinence, told her the truth, we reset, went back to step one. The third time I was just too ashamed and embarrassed. So I just started lying. I just, you know, told her that I was abstinent, and I wasn't. And that was a pattern that went on. That was, you know, what took the 17 and a half years, basically, was this pattern of I never really did gain a crap load of weight again. I mean, I'm sure that I gained 10 and 15 pounds, something like that. I had weight swings of like 40 pounds up and down, and then it went to 20 pounds up and down, and then it went to 10 pounds up and down. And I certainly felt that I could hide that. You know, I don't know if I was adequately hiding it or not, but I certainly felt that people couldn't tell, although at the same time, I was worried all the time that people could tell. You know, I was, I am the regular weaselly kind of liar. I just am. I really want people to just think that I am so slick and cool, and I don't do anything that looks openly defiant at all, ever. But I am just, you know, the sneaky kind, and nobody could be as good as I was trying to be. I'm pretty sure of that. So I had to go around corners to get my little, you know, transgressions out. So, yeah, a lot of lying. And I let groups celebrate abstinence anniversaries for me, you know, and felt horrible like a weasel. And I moved from Connecticut to Madrid, Spain, where we had English language OA meetings. And I was the meeting contact, and I was sponsoring everybody, doing tons of service, and I was this and that, and still lying about abstinence. And when I came home from Madrid to Connecticut, I was clear on one thing, which was that I was never going to be able to really be abstinent until I could figure out how to be honest. So I got a sponsor in my old group with whom I felt comfortable to tell the truth, and I told her the truth every day for a year about what I ate, whether the news was good or bad. And at the end of the year, I was abstinent, and I was honest. And I think that lasted for maybe 3 or 4 years. And I did all the stuff, you know, that I had always done. I was sponsoring lots of people, and I had a sponsor, and I was doing lots of service and, you know, going to lots of meetings. I mean, I do a lot of the stuff. I am happy to do what that person told me about relapse. I do the program. I do it. I'm a good little doobie. That's the kind of person I am. That sort of stuff is easy for me. But then somewhere along the line, it unraveled. I'm not even sure where it happened. I moved to Richmond, Virginia in 2002. Program not particularly strong there, but there were some people there that were strong, and I hooked in really well with the people there. And I know I was abstinent for a while, but the pattern reasserted itself, and there was all this lying going on and, you know, trying to mask and hide what was really going on with me and with my food. But still, you know, doing all the service and sponsoring and blah, blah, blah. And what happened was I was at a meeting one day, and somebody was the speaker at the meeting, and she had told, you know, my story about having been in relapse and now being back abstinent, and she had done it by going to an outside place, not a real full-blown treatment center, but some place that gave shorter sorts of treatment. And I walked out of that meeting, and I turned to my friend, and I said, I'm in trouble. Can you help me? And she agreed to help me. I was using a sponsor at that time. I made lots of mistakes with sponsors, usually accepting sponsorship that was not sufficient to my needs. And at that time, I had a sponsor who wasn't attending meetings and who I couldn't call, but I could only email her. And, you know, that actually is just not enough for me. And I knew it, but I was pretending that it was okay. And so my friend agreed to sponsor me. I was abstinent from that minute. I called up the intergroup chair and resigned all my intergroup positions, blah, blah. I called up the outside treatment place and signed up for a bunch of that. And during that year, I just did, I did a lot of work with that outside thing. I did a lot of work of all kinds. One of the things that came up that year was that very close to 100% of my relapses had always started with some kind of episode of people-pleasing. It was somebody made a special dessert and brought it to my house. I really had no skill to say, that's so nice of you, but I can't eat that, no thank you. Still incredibly hard for me, but, you know, as a really, really inveterate people-pleaser, I needed skills that I did not have. You know, we were going to dinner. My husband and I were going to dinner with people, and everybody wanted to go to a restaurant where I couldn't get what I needed to stay abstinent. And I would agree because I did not want to displease anybody. I have a horrible and lengthy New Year's Eve story that I won't tell you the whole thing, but we were supposed to go to New Year's with somebody, and they had double booked themselves, and they said, so we'll go to this lady's house for dinner, and she's making this and that. And I said, well, what is she making? And they told me the things she was making, and one of the things was mashed potatoes. Well, you don't know what's in mashed potatoes. I mean, that was not enough information for me to stay abstinent with the food plan that I was working at the time. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I realized that I was going to have to say, I can't go. And my husband was probably going to be really unhappy that I was keeping him from this thing that he thought would be fun. Well, I spent the afternoon calling all kinds of people. I actually had to go to a second 12-step program to help people with this problem. I had to take it very seriously, it turned out, because people-pleasing was just, it was the place that I bonked into the wall almost every time. So, yeah, what happened was I did go to an outside 12-step program for that, got a sponsor, worked the steps with the expectation that that would keep me abstinent. And what actually happened was it kept me abstinent, and I started to intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me, which I never expected. That was an unbelievable gift from my higher power. So, yeah, let's just see if I forgot anything so far. Yeah, the other thing that I acquired in that year was that there was a lady back in Connecticut who had always said, and she had a great recovery from bulimia. She always said, I'm not going to eat today. If my ass falls off today, I'm not going to eat. And I knew that if my ass fell off today, I was absolutely going to eat. I ate over all kinds of things. I mean, I ate if my in-laws came over because, you know, they were irritating. I mean, so I was like, clearly people have, I can see people in the rooms that have something that I lack. People that have some idea that no matter what, they are going to stay abstinent. But I know I don't have that. And I knew that something like that had happened when I quit smoking. I'd been a person who could pick up and put down cigarettes forever, but I always picked them up again. And one day, just the knowledge came into my head, you can never have another cigarette. And I thought, well, if I could get that knowledge for cigarettes, maybe someday, some way, that could come to me for food. So I got some information about, you know, food is not an option, and it means that for solving my problems, and I have problems every day, I can use anything but food. I can use not pleasing people. That is not a tool that I wish to pick up, not pleasing people. But that was one of the tools that I had to start picking up, one of the main things. You know, changing plans, not always being able to accept an invitation to lunch on the spur of the moment. I mean, I guarded my spontaneity like it was, I guarded my spontaneity the way that I should have guarded my abstinence. And I had to flip that. okay, I can't be 100% spontaneous, and I can't go to lunch with you anytime that you suggest it, even though I would really, really like to. So that was another one. There's a thing that I hear people say in the rooms a lot of the time that I don't identify with at all, which is, I don't have power over other people and places and things, but I have power over myself. I don't find that I have a whole lot of power over myself. When it's time to do something like acquire honesty, start acting in a different way, I actually have very, very limited ability to do anything like that. I have been thrown back upon my higher power for things like that. I can't make honesty happen. Maybe it's a question of waiting for a character defect to be removed. I don't know. But I bonk up against walls all the time that are problems that I cannot solve. And what I have found is this is the stuff that I'm supposed to go to my higher power for. This is why I'm here, to access a higher power who can do for me the stuff that I cannot do for myself. And just to say, again, I came without much spirituality. The spirituality that I have today pretty much comes from the big book from, page 417. It's really not much more sophisticated than that. But if I really accept the proposition that today everything is exactly the way that it's supposed to be, because it is the way it is, that means something in me has to be adjusted to fit in with the way things are today. And it is okay with me that I don't understand everything that my higher power has put into the world. I don't understand why the Nazis happen, and I don't understand why we can't have peace in the Middle East, and I don't understand a lot of stuff like that. And it has to be okay with me. I was at a meeting once when somebody was quoting a poem about, God's a weaver, and we only get to see the backside of the weaving, the messy side, the ugly side with the strings hanging out. We don't get to see the plan. So that's kind of the spirituality that I have to work with, because there isn't anything else for me. I mean, that's it. So now, I've had so much relief from the kinds of things, the things of the past. The steps for me have really cleared up the past a lot, and I don't spend a lot of time on resentments and regrets and things like that. All of my work I can see is about the future and fears and stuff like that. And I'm having a lot of success now that I've been in, I guess I didn't say, I moved to San Diego about 2 years ago. And, wonderful program in Southern California, obviously. And so I've been learning lots and lots of stuff, mostly from the big book, mostly about going back to the source. If I am having fears and anxieties, I am supposed to trust and rely on God. And, I was one of the people that I had a step two sort of going. I had found a higher power, and I had some kind of relationship going with a higher power, but I was not doing much trusting or relying on that higher power. So that's where I am, right now, trying to remember when I get into those places of fear that my job here, the place that I'm supposed to be, is to trust and rely on God. And, as far as that applies to relapse, I haven't had to have a relapse, thank God, in almost 9 years. And, I'm going to keep working this stuff to prevent myself from having another relapse. I think it's entirely possible I could have one. I think I have a 400-pounder or a 600-pounder in me. For me, it's about volume, not sugar or anything particular. It's volume that tamps down the feelings, but for me going forward, I'm going to try and spend more time trusting and relying on my higher power. And that's it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Last up is John Kay.
Hi, I'm John, Compulsive Eater.
Hi, John.
Hi, I want to thank Jeff for asking me. Just to qualify, I've been in program for 33 years. I have 33 years of sobriety in another program. I am, in March, we'll have 20 years of abstinence. So, like was said earlier, do the subtraction and you'll see why we're here. We're talking before the meeting saying, this should be called the Don't Do What We Did panel. But you got to imagine that 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, you talk about pitiable and incomprehensible demoralization to have been in program for 14 or so years and to be slipping and sliding and slipping and sliding. And so I was going to talk about that today. Obviously the, and I've been maintaining about 105 pound weight loss for most of that time, except during the relapse. And, Weight Watchers, I don't like applause for weight. The thing was, and I'm just going to make an overall thing that if I'm usually talking about program, it's way more about the big book and overall steps because I was asked to talk on relapse. I'm going to sort of be a little granular about the relapse and the things that I've found. And so I'm going to, you know, for the most part, talk about the things. I spent a long time in the last 20 years looking backwards at that relapse and trying to understand it. And, you know, here's a person who's got a reasonably good mind. In program, learned, you know, it, when I'm in the middle of that relapse, I could still quote you huge chunks out of, you know, the first 164 pages of the big book, quote, you know, the AA 12 and 12, and yet I'm just a mess. And the things that I realized for me is that it had to do with the fact that I didn't understand how powerlessness worked with my food. I didn't understand how the disease worked on my brain, and I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. And if you think about that, that's the first three steps, you know? And that's what I want to talk about. The idea of powerlessness for me, as it applied to my food addiction, was different than in other programs I'm in. And, you know, it's still an allergy of the body and an obsession in the mind, or as they say, you know, you can't stop and you can't stop from starting again. And, for me, I would sit there and, you know, like we said, I'm a good little student. You taught me, you told me it was powerless. I was powerless. I would get up, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, and I go eat. Then I'd come back and I'd be like, no, I'm powerless, and I go eat. And then powerless, powerless, eat, you know? And, you know, what I had to realize is how, you know, how powerless did I think I was when I went out every time? You know, was I saying, you know, oh, the heck with OA, heck with all those step programs, I'm done? No. Somewhere in the back of my head was, when I'm done, I will come back. And I will get abstinent again. And what I had to realize is that it wasn't untrue. Well, I don't know how many of you guys here have been abstinent and lost your abstinence and got it back again. But because I did it so many times, there's a part of your brain that says, well, here's the empirical evidence that I am not powerless over it because I've broken my abstinence and I've gotten abstinent again. You know, and one of those relapses, I'm thinking, okay, and now I'm gonna come back. I may have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I may have to get a new sponsor. I may do a lot of writing, but eventually I'm gonna grind that train to a halt again. And the reality was I could, and I did. So in my brain, it was the idea, I'm not powerless over the food, I am powerful over the food, and that still was true, but in the small picture. Because every time I did that, and every time I ground that train to a halt again, as soon as it came to a stop, I was setting up the next one out. It might have been down the road, it might have been God knows how long, but it was now on the agenda. You know, the clock was ticking. The clock might have gone a little longer, it might have gone a little shorter, but that's what happened to me every time, you know? And what I needed to see was, I needed to think about it differently, you know? I needed to understand that in the big picture, I was not powerful. I was powerless. You know, I remember during one of those relapses, I'm sitting there, why did I do it again? I had 4 months. And there was a little voice in my head that said, you know, you haven't been abstinent since the first time you came in. You haven't been abstinent. And I realized it was true. I hadn't been abstinent again. I had 4 months without eating. I was just on another in cycle of the in and out cycle. But was I abstinent? No, I wasn't doing any of the work of the program. And it was all that in out. And, you know, today I get it a little differently. When I first came in 33 years ago, everybody would like thump on the podium and say, we don't eat no matter what. And I heard somebody say that exact same thing, but in a nicer way. They said, if you're a compulsive eater, and you've made food an option, it's always going to be the only option. It's always going to be the path of least resistance. If you have a choice of going through some kind of emotional trauma or pain or eating something that you like the taste of and that at least at one point in your life helped you feel better, it's a no-brainer. It had to become not an option, you know. Terrell always says, if it's not an option, it's not a problem. And it's absolutely true. But I couldn't see that. I couldn't see that at the time. It was my pressure valve, you know. And today, I really get about powerlessness. You know, in the example I've set the sponsees is, I truly believe I am powerless over a bullet and a gun. You know how I know? Because I've never decided to put a gun to my head, and as I'm pulling the trigger, say, I'll start again on Monday, you know. But how many times did I do that? And I can name people that were here that are dead as a result of the relapse of their program. And the thing that's really scary is these weren't people who never got it. They had it. They gave it away, and I guarantee not one of them said, well, I'm going to go out, and then I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be constantly slip and slide, and then I'm going to leave, I'm going to get disgusted with OA, and then I'm going to die. Because if that disease had done that to them, they would have not done that, you know? And that's where the other part of moving into step two is the insanity of this disease. The insanity, which the really frustrating thing is it's such a specific insanity because a lot of us are incredibly accomplished and in all other areas of our life except this one, you know? And what I had to realize, and it morphed, you know, the way my disease worked on me before I came to the program was totally different than how my disease worked on me when I was in my relapse. Because my disease just took all of that knowledge in that book and just figured out how to twist it and warp it and throw it back as to the reason I should go eat. You know, and the lady named Marcy who's around here, she always says you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain, you know, and that was my problem. My brain is so wonderful in so many other areas of my life that I can do things with, but I had to realize I was the worst person to figure out how to get better. I could have taken anybody off the street and been better off than the brain here. And part of it is the way my disease works. I always like to say my disease is like the world's best salesman. You know, think of somebody you know who's like a really good salesman. They're fun and they're nice and they're good, you know, and they're telling you how wonderful a product is. Well, that's like my disease is the best salesman. And then imagine that really good salesman can read your mind. So not only is he going to have a great sales technique, anything you're going to say has to be no, he's got the answer for, right? And the trouble is that's what my disease does. It just keeps pounding away. That salesman keeps pounding away trying to make the sale. And the really sad thing about it is when the disease used to make the sale to me and I went and ate, while I'm eating, it puts its arm around me and says, you know, this was your idea. The thing is, if it wasn't my idea. At the moment, it felt like my idea. But you got to know, in the middle of that relapse, I mean, I'm tell a story. I was secretary of artists and abstinence meeting, and I leave the meeting and I stop at the donut shop on the way home, and I'm like, what am I doing? I'm not sentenced to OA. You know, over in the other program, you can actually get, but I didn't have to do that. I didn't want to eat, or I wouldn't have been the secretary. I wouldn't have had a sponsor. I wouldn't have been a sponsor. I wouldn't have been a Dell. All those things I was doing told me I really didn't want to eat. But at that exact moment, my disease said, no, this was your idea. And that was the thing I couldn't see as to how crazy I was, you know. My disease wants to always, and it really helped me to start to change my thinking of those kind of thoughts being my disease attacking me, not just me changing my mind for the 5,000th time, you know. And my disease is always pushing me toward the easier, softer way, trying to convince me in this program the shit it used to try. And, I'm sorry, I'm being recorded on that. The stuff it used to try and convince me before, you know, I would try every other new fad diet, all those things. And then I came here, and there has to be the new fad diet form of OA somewhere, right? Because that's what I kept looking for, you know. And it kept trying to get me to negotiate my recovery. That was the other thing. I think it's Ira who says you can't negotiate with your disease. It always wins, you know. And it really is true. And I heard a great line somebody said once. He said, look, when it comes to your program, you can do what you want or you can get what you want. And I realized that's a great, you know, way to look at things, you know. But the trouble is that now I'm insane in program, and it's using all perfectly good program slogans and concepts that on their own are good, but I'm the diseased person taking them and getting them warped around. Like I used to talk, well, I've got to be gentle myself, you know. So I had an abstinence that like Henry VIII could follow, you know. Or, well, I can't be on a diet. You know, guess what? We're all on diets. I've been on a no-liver diet since I left home, okay? I know, right? Or, you know, I remember saying one time, you know, I was going to this meeting regularly when I was in the slip-on. Well, I ate again last night, but I won't beat myself up. You know, and it'd come the next day. Well, I ate again, but I'm not going to beat myself up. And finally, an old-timer said, well, isn't eating last night beating yourself up, too? And it's true. I mean, you know, I was just a mess, you know. I'll work the steps, and then the food will take care of itself. That's the one there's this little pesky first step, you know, that says you can't then say, and when I'm done, I will be abstinent if you really believe you're powerless. And, yeah. And my favorite was, well, I'm praying for the willingness. You know, I heard a lady at a convention once say, you know, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know, if Dr. Bob and Bill had to wait until they were willing, there still wouldn't be a program. You know, desperation and pain works a lot better than willingness, you know. And it's not that any of those things were bad, but my disease was taking and warping and twisting him because it was just trying to get to do its main job. But here's the thing. My disease got up every day during my relapse with one job to do. And that job that day was to figure out how to get me to kick the can down the road one more day on not putting the food down. And if you could do it by saying, well, I'll work on the spiritual part first, or I'll do this first, or, you know, all perfectly good things done once one puts down the food and try to get me to put that first, like that would work, you know? And the reality is, the reality check here is we're in a program based on Alcoholics Anonymous. Is anybody read that big book and found anywhere in there it says, when you're done doing all this stuff, then you will want to get sober? No. It presupposes everybody gets. No, you've got to put it down, and then you can start the work. I love the phrase, put down the food, pick up the steps. You know, literally simultaneously. Because what it's about, we're giving up the thing that got us through, and now we're going to be really in a white-knuckle situation. But now if you get right into this, it can change. It's the hardest thing to say to some people sometimes. There's a great guy out here named Al S., and he's got 40-plus years in this program and 50-plus in AA. And he said to me one time, you know, the problem is that there's a lot of people in OA who found a higher power before they found a food plan. You know? And if you understand, it's the same kind of thing that I was doing. Well, I'm working with my higher power, you know, and there's nothing wrong with the higher power, but I needed to understand things differently. You know, I really believe today the real concept in terms of 12-step higher power thinking is the most important thing about me getting the idea of a higher power is that I get that I am a lesser power. Way most important in the world. What that higher power is nowhere near as important as me getting the idea I'm a lesser power. And in fact, I'm a great believer in a hierarchy of higher powers. You know, when I was coming out of relapse, I needed a sponsor way more than I needed a higher power at that exact moment. Obviously, we all need a higher power, but at the exact moment, I needed somebody who would help me, who would, it's been said here today, take direction, somebody I could trust and take my brain out of the driver's seat and get some help, because that was actually the last thing I wanted, you know. It was so important to be done, you know. I mean, I joke, I go, I'll go into a room and pray to God and come out convinced that God told me chocolate's a vegetable, you know. And the trouble is I call my sponsor and he's like, nah, not today. But that's the truth. You know, I believe in a higher power that works through people, and I believe in a higher power, but I also believe in sponsors. I believe in a God squad I have, and that I want to take it all in. And, you know, because if this was totally a matter, I was just talking to somebody about this before, if this was totally a matter of conscious contact with a higher power, how do you explain the people I know in this program that are priests, rabbis, cantors, nuns, ministers? If it was a matter of just having a conscious contact with a higher power, never would need it, right? People were dying of alcoholism until 1935 and compulsive eating until 1960 with no hope, yet there were loads of devout people of all religions, and it wasn't helping. This is the rowboat. We're sitting here in the middle of the rowboat right now. God sent us a rowboat, and we got to row to shore. I can't make it this ethereal higher power when the thing I needed to do was to get a sponsor and say, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Help. Help. I will stop. I got 14 years in program. I'll quote you the big book left and right. I'm done. Tell me what to do. That's the key. It was, to me, the key to getting better. You know, losing the debate society. I heard, you know, I always had trouble with the phrase turning it over, you know. Then I heard somebody put it much, like a different way, and they said removing the blockage of self-will, You know, get out of the way. Let somebody else for a while. My old AA sponsor used to say, if you could have done this yourself, you'd have done it by now. You know, your own best thinking, as much as you could get together, is where you were when you dragged your dead ass in here the first time. I remember these things from like my first days in program. I needed to quit the debating society, and I needed to see I'm powerless over the food, you know, and I needed help. And for me, at that point, the second step, a sponsor was the most important. And I needed to essentially be willing to do what I was told for a while, you know. And one of the first things he did was sit down and work out a food plan. I needed to look, you know, the red light, green light, yellow light foods. I always joke. I said, I know what my green light foods are, and I pretty much know what my red light foods are. And all the rest of them are yellow light foods where I'm hitting the accelerator trying to make it through. And they really should be red light foods, and I'm screwing around, and I know it. And over the years, that's gotten to be a smaller thing. But I truly believe a food plan needs to be said. You know, I was really good friends with Roseanne, and Roseanne used to say, I didn't start OA to be a fat and happy club. You know, it's meant to be more. And I always joke, you know, everybody's probably heard the cliche, OA without spirituality is a diet. And I always say that's true, but you know, OA without a food plan is a great program. It's called Al-Anon. If you think, no, Al-Anon's a wonderful program to help you integrate your 12 steps in your life and give you a better life, but it's not going to help you with your food without working on the food part of the food plan. And I really think sometimes we sort of pander to people's diseases and tell them they're never going to have to give up anything. And we're doing the same thing that a billion-dollar diet industry does, telling people they can get what they want and do what they want, you know? And I really believe it. For me, I really had to get this stuff down on paper. My disease loves vagueness, you know. It loves, I don't know. It'll just go to town on it. But I had to work a food plan out that was going to be for the long term, too. Because I was in another program for a few years. And I always say my program, my abstinence needs to, my food plan needs to be strong, but it can't be brittle. You know, because something that's brittle, when you drop it, it smashes into 1,000 pieces. But it's hard. You're trying to work on a food plan. And I always say it's like having one foot on either side of a steeply pitched roof, and you can just roll off in either direction. And one is, well, I ate that, and I won't beat myself up. Well, okay, I'm going to let that go. And the next thing you know, I am the most forgiving 400-pound guy you ever met, you know. But the other way is I ate a pea I shouldn't have. What the hell? Give me the sheet cake. You know? But to find that line, because we do define our absence here, but for me, I couldn't do it by myself. I needed help. Otherwise, I'm giving the inmates the keys to the asylum, you know? And it just wouldn't work. And I know I'm talking a lot about a food plan, but for me, I needed to do that. And I'm also a big believer in scales. I'm not saying weigh and measure constantly. I mean, I've gotten it down now. I could hit you 4 ounces of protein and, you know, and within a hundredth of a pound, I think. And I don't take them to restaurants or things like that. But I do believe in sometimes, and I will buy in bulk and freeze to do that, to weigh a little. Because I can go to like one of those really good steakhouses, get a steak this big and look at it and go, yeah, that's 4 ounces. And I don't know because I'm insane. And the other one is the weighing scale, the weight scale. I'm a big believer in once a month. Once a month, get on the scale, because they're my denial busters, you know? And, I hear people say, I never get on a scale. Because I used to get on it all the time. Yeah, but you also binged every day, and you're managing to be abstinent. Can't you be on a scale plan, just like a food plan, and have some moderation with that? Because here's the problem, and you're talking to the king of denial about this. I was in the middle of doing crazy stuff, and then my weight's going up and up and up, and I think I'm fine, you know? But when I think I'm fine, and I get on my scale, and I'm up 10 pounds, I have a real interesting scientific question to ask myself. Has gravity stopped being a constant, or am I screwing around with the food, and I don't realize it? And that's the thing. And I realize that I'm, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking about things there, but since this is a relapse panel, you know, I could go on and on about the steps in the big book too, but to me that's the most important thing is trying to deal with the insanity of my disease, you know. And I'll wrap up I had a sponsee once, and I was talking about our disease and the problems we have. And I quoted the great line from More About Alcoholism, and I said, you know, it's the great desire of every compulsive eater to someday eat like normal people. And he goes, no, we don't. No, we don't. A normal person eats one little piece of cake and goes, oh, that's too rich. I don't understand the phrase too rich in any definition of the word rich, right? No, we want to eat what we want to eat and have no ramifications. I want Terrell's abstinence. I want Terrell's 30-something years in program without doing a damn thing that Terrell did. Somehow the abstinence fairy will come down and hit me on the wand, in the head with the wand. And that's part of the insanity. And the insanity of my disease doesn't go away just because I walk in here or I say I really want to get abstinent. It's a matter of doing it. Like somebody said, it's not for those who want it. It's not for those who need it. It's for those who do it. So thanks.
Thank you, John. Now at the time for questions and answers, please raise your hand and I will call on as many questioners as possible. Your question can be directed at one person specifically or generally for the panel to answer. Please be aware that we are recording this panel, and when asking a question, your voice may be audible on the recording. Since we have a little bit more time, we can go for 25 minutes. Who would like to ask the first question?
My name is George. I'm a compulsive overeater. George. Many of the long-timers that I've ever met have all experienced some relapse. Okay? Very simple question. Is it better in the long term to experience a relapse than not?
So I'm just going to repeat the question. Is it in the long term, is it better to have experienced relapse or not?
I can only say for me, I had to have gone through that. I know my personality type. I literally had my first abstinence. It was the easiest grace abstinence because, and here's the other thing I can tell you is that I think I always say in my regular share that I was on 1,000 diets before I came to OA, and when I first started, I used to say none of them worked, but the reality is they all worked. They all worked once because I'm a good little student. You give me a syllabus, I'm going to follow it. And what I realized that first grace abstinence I had in OA was just another one of those diets where I came in and said, tell me what to do, and I did it. But then at some point, I got the addict's brain that wants to start negotiating and finding the loopholes. And so I really felt in a lot of ways it was like, I was like, I don't know what the age, because I don't have kids, but there's that age where the kids are in the high chair and they drop something on the floor to see if you'll pick it up and put it back up so that they drop it again. Well, that was me. I had the easiest abstinence in the world, and I figured, screw it, I'll get it back, you know? And I think I have a much stronger abstinence now, having gone through the crap I did, because I can hear now and understand my disease working harder for me on me. So, anybody? Yeah.
I'm over 90 pounds down, okay? But I'm scared to death that at some point in time I'm going to lose it. And I'm almost thinking, here's the crazy brain. Yeah. And early, okay?
Yeah.
And then get back on it again. But eventually it's going to happen.
I can say that anything will keep you absent, including fear. Sometimes, I mean, I always like to say it, but there's times I think about these guys I know that are dead and think, you know, that's it for me. Anybody else? I don't want to be the hog.
No, I do believe there's such a thing as healthy fear, and fear of relapse to me is a healthy fear.
Yeah. I'm good. I mean, do you have enough of an answer?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Got a lot of time.
Hi, I'm Reba, a compulsive overeater. Hi, Reba.
So the question is, how do you trust a sponsor?
Hi, I'm Susan, compulsive overeater. Don't know if this is a right answer or a wrong answer. How do you trust a sponsor? In the beginning, I was just grateful that somebody was willing to take my call, and that for me at the time that she'd lost 100 pounds. So I did that, and then the more I spoke to her, and there was this silence, and there wasn't any judgment, and it just came with time. The more conversations we had and the more she just listened and I didn't feel judged, the more I trusted. So I just think it takes time. It takes what it takes. It takes time to get to know people in any relationship. It takes time to forge that together. And I don't think it's any different here, but people in these rooms I just have a different trust with. So I knew that she had gone before me. She had certainly a lot more time and not eating one day at a time than I did, and that was all I cared about at the time. So that's how it's worked for me, and I've never had an incident in these rooms where somebody's given me cause not to trust them, to be honest with you.
Somehow I was graced. Because I remember times in the program where I just had 3 meals a day. I didn't have the sugar. But some of my meals got so crazy in what I called a meal. So, and also I was terrifically motivated by people pleasing in my early years. So now it's positive and negative. Now I have no more fear of people pleasing. I'm getting too old for that, you know. However, it's really difficult for me. I enjoy what every one of you said, but it's difficult to know what exactly is the right way for me. But I did hear, I have a sponsor now, and I love how she sponsors me. Only I know that I'm not completely honest, and that I haven't been absolutely rigorously honest because my pride still keeps me just making gray what ought to be black and white. You know what I mean? No, I use this food, and it is. So my question is, how do you, I feel completely lost right now after hearing every way. And, I hear, in a way, what I think is it best to just simply act like you trust, even if you don't, and say, here I am, tell me what to do. Like I did early in the book. I mean, just get your sponsor and let go of the pride and vanity and just say, here I am. You tell me what to do for a while, because I'm lost.
So the question is, how do you
surrender? How do you surrender?
Yeah. How do you surrender?
And I get that now.
So how do you surrender and do what you're being asked to do?
I have a thing about submission and surrender. It's been a big problem for me. I can submit all day long. I said, I'm a really good doobie. I will do all the stuff. Surrender for me was something that, one of those things that I am not able to make happen for myself. I had to pray for it. I had to pray for it for probably 2 years when I realized it was the thing that I was lacking. I was on my knees every day for 2 years saying, God, please bust my will and give me surrender. Please bust my will and give me surrender. And when I talk to people about it now, you know, I will suggest stuff like try not knowing the best about everything. Try not being the smartest one in the room. These are problems that I have. You know, I just had to stop knowing everything. I just had to stop figuring it out, and I had to beg. Somebody gave me the Dr. Harry Tebow stuff way too early in this program, and I was very, very confused by it, but at this late date, that's what I've come back to, that there's a big difference between submission and surrender. Surrender, for me, is an unconscious process that I can't make happen for myself.
Well, there's a guy who's running a workshop right now who always says, surrender's just going over to the winning side. Which I always like. And I go back, my first 12-step program, they're not as dainty here as they are here. And I remember them, you know, saying, how's your way working for you? You know, is it working? Don't change it if it's working. But, and I, like I said earlier, I think there was a part of me that just finally said, you know, that whole insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, the same thing for me was I was still making all the decisions. And I wasn't joking before, and I think I find my surrender was anybody's got to be better at deciding this stuff than I am. You know, and I sponsor people now. I've got a long time in program, and it's a peer thing at a certain point. It's more about you have an objective person who has your best interest at heart to help you. It's not a, you know, I don't think of it as a superior, inferior thing. It's about objectivity. I'll never be able to be objective in my food decisions, you know. And, you know, like I said, it's just to have somebody who says, well, you know, you know, like I'll say to sponsees, I'm never going to tell you what to eat, but I'm the honesty police here. When you tell me in June you don't want to eat bread anymore, and then somewhere in where we're talking in July you're talking about eating bread, I'm just going to say, just in case you forgot. Not telling them they can't, but, you know, because that's what we do. We play games. And I needed somebody to help me stop playing the games because, again, I had the broken brain and I couldn't fix it with a broken brain.
So the question is, how do you learn to trust yourself to sponsor as a sponsor after relapse in the past?
You know, for me, and every sponsor does it differently. My first sponsor didn't let me sponsor other people until I'd done all 12 steps. My sponsor today is in AA. So if you've got one day of not drinking, you're going to help the next man who's coming in. So everybody's different, but I have to stop deciding how I'm going to do it. So that was the word I kept on hearing you say, how am I going to trust myself? I'm never going to trust myself. However, working with others in the room, becoming a part of the we of the program and not overthinking and stop, you know, writing that thesis in my head of how am I going to do it, that's what helps. So whoever your sponsor is today, that is between you and her to decide. But no, I can't trust myself to do those things. But together with all of you, I'm quite a trustworthy person. And sometimes, yes, to show up for other people does help people one day at a time. So I would just take it one day at a time. I would stop wondering about it, and I would talk to your sponsor and take that clear-cut direction that's given to you. That's just
sort of what she just said. The two things that I always heard, you know, it's like the announcement they make on the airplane, put the mask over your own mouth first, otherwise you're not going to be able to help anybody else, to make sure you're in a position to be able to do it. I'm sort of the old school of, hey, you can always help somebody else. And one places I get the most pushback from sponsees is when I tell them I'd like them to start sponsoring. Oh, no, I can't. I'm in that. You know, no, it's okay. And what I've always told them, I remember telling this to somebody once when Carl used to be my sponsor. I said, if you don't have an answer, call me. If I don't have an answer, I call Carl. Carl calls Jack. Jack calls Terrell. Terrell calls Natalie. And Natalie calls God. And God picks up for Natalie. But the whole idea that I don't have to have all the answers. One of the things I loved about Carl one time was that I was griping about a relationship problem, and he went, hey, I'm gay, I'm not in a relationship, I'm the last person you want to ask. And I really appreciated his need to not be the know-all and be-all, and he could just say, here, why don't you go talk to so-and-so, you know? And but, you know, I love the idea of kick it upstairs if you don't have the answer. And if you feel, you know, sometimes we act out our stuff in giving advice, and if you're not sure, you know, kick it upstairs.
P.S. Take up service positions. Get there early, put up the chairs, do those kinds of things first. Just start being of service right there.
As a sponsor who seem to just fade away, stop contacting, are never heard from again. What advice could you give a sponsor to help someone that is experiencing relapse?
So the question is, what advice do you have for a sponsor who has not relapsed to give to sponsees who are or have relapsed?
So when I used to come in and out, which was very, very frequent, and if you said to me, I'd like to sponsor you, I would say yes, because I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I didn't want you to feel bad about yourself. So I would probably call you the next morning. Then you'd give me an assignment, and I'd be doing this at the other end of the phone, and I wouldn't call you back the next day. And because everybody in here is so kind and loving, a couple of days would go by, and you would call me. I was already, I'd gone off. I was done. I was back up here, hated everything and everyone I was eating. So I didn't call you back. And all I know is when I've had people do that with me now, I will give them a call like a week later maybe. But more than anything, to let them know that we love you, we welcome you back, and whenever you're ready, even if you don't want to work with me, it has nothing to do with that. You are welcome to come here. And every time I walked back in, those same people who I didn't phone and who I was doing this to at the other end came over and gave me a hug. So I know here this is about the language of love, it's about the language of the heart, and that's all I can offer. So, you know, if that helps you a little bit. So just be loving and kind, whether they call back or not.
Is it got the stories in it? No, it doesn't have the stories. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. I wanted to know about what dealing with having been in a relapse. I don't want to. It sounds like you've had really bad health problems, so I'm not in any way trivializing this. But I've had sponsees call me and go, you know, this is what happened, and that's why I ate, or this is what happened, and that's why I ate. And I said, well, I've said to them, well, when that happened, did you have an urge to go place a bet on a horse? And they'd look at me like I was crazy. I go, that's because you're not a compulsive gambler. Exact same person in it would be calling their GA sponsor and say, well, this thing happened, and that's why I, in other words, the thing I need to remember more than anything is I'm a compulsive eater, and that's why I eat, not because of anything else. And this, well, it's on page 450 in the big book, but I'm going to paraphrase it. It says something to the effect of, no matter what happens or doesn't happen in my life, it can't affect my sobriety. The tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse. There are good times and there are bad times. If I make my sobriety contingent on any of those, it's done. And it's true. There's going to be absolutely the worst shitty days of our lives are ahead of us. Mr. Personality. But the reality is, I can't eat over it. I can't eat over it because it's not going to change it. And if I do, I've opened that door again, and that pressure valve will have let off. And then the next time, it will be something almost as bad as that. And then the next time, it'll be something less than that. And it'll be the next time I break my shoelace, I'm going to 7-Eleven. And it has to somehow be totally divorced. And it's hard. I know when you're talking about something really impactful, but again, the idea of seeing that, no, I'm a compulsive eater. That's why I think of going for food. A normie doesn't, you know, and I don't think of going for gambling. I use that as the example because it's like the one addiction I have no anything with.
Yeah, I just say pray for surrender. That's all I got.
Yeah. We have about 5 more minutes. Any other questions? Any of you willing to discuss your food plan?
Okay, so I already said that my absence was no flour, no sugar. My food plan has definitely evolved over the years. There were certain foods that made me nervous. I wasn't quite sure. I even had a thing with grapes in the beginning. I didn't want to weigh them because I like a bunch of grapes. I didn't want to weigh out 6 to 8 ounces. So I didn't have those on my food plan for a while because it made me really sad to look at what a portion was. today, 15 years later, I eat them and I can eat them like a lady, but I don't buy them a lot because they can tend to smile at me when the fridge door opens. You know, they're just like popping pills.
Yeah.
So my food plan is 3 meals a day. As of now, it's with nothing in between. I've tried it with snacks. Snacks get loud. Snacks talk. You know, they're like, it's almost time. And I find that I'm watching the watch. And I have 3 balanced meals. My breakfast has basically been the same for years because it's the breakfast that I enjoy. And I weigh and measure when I'm at home. I do not take the scale into a restaurant. There's nothing more demoralizing. And I know, like you said, I could take you out with that scale and measure your food for you with my eyes closed. I know it. I know it. They say the palm of the hand, I got it down. You want 4 ounces of cooked chicken, I'll give it to you. So certain foods have involved. I stayed away from certain ethnic foods in the beginning when I was losing weight because I just kind of didn't know how to do that and didn't feel really safe that I wasn't going to have an extra big scoop. Today, I can eat most foods that were in the perimeters of no flour, no sugar. And again, just that I just have to keep it honest. So when I'm at home, I weigh and I measure it and I do it. But, you know, I think I eat a very varied meals. I think if you went out with me and you didn't know me, you probably wouldn't know. You just think, oh, she's such a girl. She's not having any bread. You know, you wouldn't know in the same way as no dessert. Thank you. So it definitely evolves over time. And, you know, I mean, really most people would think grapes, but that was something that I had a hard time with. So.
Yeah, mine is, my food plan and my abstinence are the same. And it's, no sugar, flour, alcohol, caffeine, or artificial sweeteners. And then it's, you know, weighed and measured at home and don't go out to restaurants. Don't go looking for restaurants too much because I'll tell you, I don't weigh and measure in restaurants and I suck at eyeballing. I cannot be trusted at all with eyeballing. So, you know, breakfast is an ounce of grain, a cup of milk, a piece of fruit, and an ounce of protein. Lunch is 2 ounces of protein, 2 cups of vegetables, 1 fat, you know what a fat is. It's a tablespoon of dressing or a teaspoon of oil, and 1 starch. Snack in the late afternoon is a cup of milk and a fruit, and dinner is 3 ounces of protein, 2 cups of vegetables, 1 fat, 1 starch, 1 fruit. That's it.
And, well, I have really boring except for dinner. I eat the same thing for breakfast and the same thing for lunch. I have cereal. I have an exact kind of thing. I pour it into a thing and then there and with some, fruit. And lunch I have hot dogs and a half a thing of soup and, sauerkraut. That goes back to my dieting days. Sauerkraut and pickles are like the free foods. Anyway. Okay, you can't lose certain things in your life. And dinner is usually about 4 ounces. And I got to tell you, I'm getting to that age where keeping the weight off is more about death by a thousand cuts, butter, cheese on things. I'm not talking about, you know, the little added things. All of a sudden, I've been just dealing with bringing back off some weight because I realize it just queues up because my metabolism is gone. But essentially, I ate about 4 ounces of protein at dinner, and usually I've actually gotten away from grains lately, mainly vegetables, and I have a snack at night. I call that my deferred dessert. It's, you know, usually fruit or something like that. But the other thing is the red light foods. You know, for me, bread is become a way bigger thing than sugar was when I was younger. I allow myself to have bread if I'm going to have it with the protein, like if I'm making a sandwich. But even then, I don't keep bread at home. I have certain things I can eat out, but I don't keep in the house because I can't trust myself to eat them like a gentleman. And like was just said, I have to limit how often I go to a restaurant because to me, dining in restaurants is licensed to overeat. Because I can sit, you know, I always joke, nobody ever went broke in America having a restaurant that served too much food, you know. And it's just ridiculous. You go to some of these places and it's like, you know, you might as well, you know, put, you know, might as well put like snow on the top. It goes up so high. Anyway.
All right. Thank you all for participating. I would like to thank Susan and John for sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Because we are the last panel, there's an announcement. If you are leaving for the day, they would like to recycle your badge holders if you could drop it off by the registration desk. So. This concludes the panel discussion for today. There are marathon meetings until 10 p.m. tonight and 2 more panels. and a sober eating workshop tomorrow morning at 9:30. Thank you for letting me be of service, and have a good evening.